Education Subcommittee of the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. This is Monday, April 7th, and we will be having a public hearing on House Bill 5021, which is the budget bill for the Department of Higher Education. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 5021. And we have some historical funding information that the LFO office, Mr. Bender's, prepared for us. But in the interest of moving the agenda along today and not taking up any more of the president's time than we need to, we'll defer that information until tomorrow. Mr. Jarvis, I understand you have some information that you want to present to us.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. For the record, Richard Jarvis, Chancellor of the Oregon University System. Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for your weekend study and getting back to us today, and we hope that that was a helpful process. I will do my best to provide you with an introduction this morning to the way in which we've been planning for reductions, both this year and as we project on into the forthcoming biennium. And, of course, we have been dealing with that as the various reductions have taken place. I'd like to give a brief introductory statement on the processes and principles we've used for that, then hand over to Vice Chancellor Andrews, who will lead you through the reduction scenarios that you asked us for at 2, 4, 6, 8, and 10%, and with your permission, we would propose to start at 6 and move through the latter stages in the reality of where the budget is, and then turn to the presidents for them to give you a flavor of what is happening on the individual campuses, if that is satisfactory.
Proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. If I may then begin with the story of where we are at the present time. And our first challenge throughout this year has been to get out of 2003. We've been faced with, as you all know very well, reductions in general fund during the year. And we've responded to that in a variety of ways, some of which have involved short-term planning, others of which, frankly, have been pretty well crisis responses to various allotment controls. As we've responded to those reductions, I think we've stepped down through a series of adjustments, and I just say a word about each of them, and pretty well in this order. Naturally, when funds are reduced, the first thing you do is cut administration and look for opportunities to either eliminate services or provide services in a more efficient manner. An example of that is the central service office of the system, the Chancellor's office. And during the course of this year, that's been reduced by about 13%, which is a couple of points more than the overall budget reduction for the system. We've gone through that phase of reductions. We've taken the position that we should do our best to preserve access this year. There have, in fact, been no limits on admission during 2002-03, but there have been increases in class size as we've attempted to maintain enrollments of existing students and existing admitted students. We have, however, then, as the reductions grow, reduced support services. And the presidents will tell you about the impacts on things like library hours, computing center, counseling. And then after that, the next thing that goes is a reduction in class section availability, as we're unable to maintain either classes with low enrollments or we're unable to add additional classes of relatively low enrollments. And then the last resort, and we've had to go to that obviously during this year, is to raise tuition. Surcharges, which were related to Measure 28, are now regrettably looking all too permanent, and we have had to increase tuition remissions to mitigate the impact on the most needy students, as we told you last week. Those were our responses so far this year. What we've tried to avoid is elimination of academic programs with enrolled students. We are in a mid-year situation, and we would simply have no place to send those students. We have an obligation to teach students through their programs. So we've attempted to protect academic programs with enrolled students. We've tried to avoid jeopardizing our relationships with the rest of K-16. We're a pipeline situation. With students coming to us both from K-12 and from the community colleges, we've tried to protect those avenues for incoming students. And we've tried to avoid dismantling the research infrastructure as we face these short-term and immediate crises. How do we then pass from 2003 into what looks like an equally challenging and enduring biennium in 2003-05? Well, I'd like to take a moment to address what we do to plan budgets at times of growth, a fond memory, and realistically, diminishing resources, the present and prospective future. And I'll try and explain these a little more clearly than I did last Thursday. And I must say, I've confused enough groups of students in my time to recognize when I wasn't getting my words across. So let me try again, if I may, address the mysteries of the RAM and budgets and enrollments. In the good days, on the upside, when funds were increasing, whether general fund or tuition and fees, when enrollment demand was growing, the RAM was a device, as Mr. Bender pointed out, to distribute funding to campuses that meet their budgeted enrollment targets and to allocate growth dollars to those campuses that go beyond those targets. And it works very well in that process. I think everyone would agree it has stimulated growth over the last several biennia, and it has helped to encourage more entrepreneurial activity among the campuses to drive those that can to grow as fast as they can. The challenge comes on the downside when we have the combination of decreasing resources, the combination of general fund and tuition, and yet still growing demand for enrollment, more people wanting to come to us still each year. And what we've tried to do is this. We've used the RAM, and in the plans that you'll hear about today, we've used the RAM to withdraw funds at the 6, 8, and 10% reduction scenarios that you gave us to respond to. And that withdrawal of funds takes funds away from the campuses based on their enrollment mix, just as it added funds to the campuses based on their enrollment mix on the way upside of the budget. So we have fully used the RAM to withdraw funded enrollments. What our board has struggled with is the extent to which we continue to see the funding per student total, general fund and tuition, shrink, and what that does to the provision of services. So what the board has asked is that we maintain a commitment to the performance that we can achieve at the current level of dollars per FTE. It's not the place we'd like to be, but it's the place we are, and our concern is that as that number shrinks, then the ability to provide services to students will also shrink. However, whatever number we end up at, it is always possible for some institutions to enroll additional students on the margin. And we're asking those campuses that can do that to do so, as long as they can maintain their performance quality for their students in the aggregate, recognizing that students supported on the margin are providing only the tuition and fees that they bring with them, that the state funding has in fact run out at that point. So that's the sense in which, Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're seeking to use the RAM in the way it was built, on the upside, to use it back on the downside, and then to say, but can we do anything on the margin to maximize enrollment for this system? And as you'll see, we can do some, but we can't do everything.
Chancellor Jarvis, I think that the committee would benefit from more information about the students on the margin. Can you tell me or just talk to us very generally about where you would expect those students to show up in terms of which campuses can absorb them, and what kind of numbers we're talking about in relation to the population of students?
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. If I could leave the numbers of students to the campus presidents who will be speaking to you. The question here depends on where we end up with the overall reduction on the state side. And the state side and the tuition combine together to determine for us the total support for students. So each president has been asked, what could you do on the margin at different levels of reduction? And assuming we are able to secure the tuition increases that we've requested, what then could you do to add additional students? Some campuses seem to be able to do that. Others would feel they're going to have to hold the line at where they are. What we believe we're trying to accomplish here is to do the best we can statewide and regionally for this system.
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I apologize. I have to go to another committee to testify, but my basic understanding of this now is a bit different than last week. I think what you're worried about is there's some probably geographically more rural campuses that potentially could be in trouble as far as funding is concerned as their population grows slowly, but grows. And they will receive needed funding. But the concern is that if you were just leave that open, that the quality of those areas might be jeopardized, and that's what you're trying to avoid. Whereas geographically, other campuses which are in like Portland State or others that are in large cities, will continue to grow faster and would pull funds away at a higher rate than you had planned on. That would in fact jeopardize the local universities or rural universities. I'm kind of getting that sense, and so I hope that's what's going on here. And so you tried to adjust the RAM model in a way that you would not lose those rural universities. Is that basically what's going on here?
Madam Chair, Representative Banks, yes, that is certainly a part of what is going on here. If I could perhaps generalize the connotation of rural to faster growing versus slower growing. Those institutions which would be able to grow faster typically could provide opportunities for more students on the margin. Those institutions who can meet their enrollments, who have met their obligation to the state and who have provided what they were asked to do, but who cannot add additional students on the margin as quickly, would then suffer if those additional students were put back through the RAM. Is that?
Yes.
I have a slide that gets a little closer to this in a second, if I could jump to it, or would you like me to?
I'm really in dilemma here. I've got to get down to another committee, Madam Chair. I'll come back as quick as I can. I think the numbers that the university presidents can tell us would probably be very helpful, and we're going to get those in a few minutes.
I think that the numbers are what we need to clarify the situation, and I would hate to think of you holding up the whole process in the building here. So.
Yeah, I'm going to get in. I'll be right back.
I think that we have had some challenges here in trying to grasp the totality of the picture that you've been presenting us. And I think that as we work through the cuts that you're bringing forward to the system, that I would just urge the committee members to feel very free to ask questions to try to get the picture straight about where the system wants to go with the economies that have to be made. I recognize this is very complex and that you're dealing with campuses that have very divergent bases and are growing into quite different areas. But please bear with us as we continue to try to get a picture of what it is that you're proposing to do here. And with that, I would just urge you to continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'll be giving you the general policy piece, and then Vice Chancellor Andrews will step down through the 6, 8, 10%, and I think there you'll see the numbers that shrink at the fundable level, and it will become clearer what these numbers are. But if I could just take two more slides, perhaps, to address the approach on this. The challenge then comes that there is a point where however much enrollment you attempt to take on the margin, if the cuts for the system exceed 6 to 8%, then the volume on the margin will probably not be able to equal the reduction of funded students on the state side. And at that point, we're left with the very worst set of choices. We would either have to reduce the state dollars per FTE, and that would clearly have adverse performance impacts. That would reduce the basic funding per student. Or we'd have to recognize that enrollment across the system will decline, certainly temporarily.
Now, may I ask for clarification here? Will the enrollment decline, or will it simply not grow?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, beyond the point of a 6% general fund reduction, our numbers would actually start to decline from where they are this year, the current year. So in our current year, we have approximately 59,000 FTE fundable students and approximately 11,000 FTE non-fundable, the non-residents.
Do you have any kind of a graph, some kind of visual that can show us, based on levels of cuts in state support, what you expect the declining enrollment to be?
Yes, Madam Chair. We'll be getting to those as we step through the 6, 8, 10% scenarios. And I think we would probably all agree that we can't go any further with tuition, which would be the other source of revenue to deal with the situation. The question then becomes, and I think the tough planning choice that the board has wrestled with, that we're wrestling with, and that we will ask your assistance with, is how do we achieve equitable reductions if we're faced with, as looks increasingly likely, reductions? Next slide, please. If the idea of enrollment on the margin, supported by tuition and fees alone, if that is not acceptable, that idea is rejected and all enrollment is forced through the RAM, then a series of very, I would argue, undesirable consequences will occur. If we do that, we'll drive our state dollars per FTE below their current levels. And our board has said to you and said to us, we've tried to make the point, that our current levels are approaching difficult levels of quality of services for our students. And we would ask not to have to do that. In addition, the faster growth campuses will drive a downward spiral at the slower growth campuses, even though everyone is meeting their targets. And I emphasize that. Even though everyone is meeting their targets, is meeting their obligation as provided for by state funds, and are providing spaces for students that students want. What happens then is we get into an access imbalance. We would add enrollment at the faster growing campuses, but in fact lose it even more at the slower growing campuses. And it's hard to see how that would net out if you're trying to maximize access for the state as a whole. The difficulty is that those students displaced at the slower growing campuses, many of them are place bound and simply can't transfer. It's not a matter of saying, well, if we reduce the number of seats at campus X, they can all just get in the car and transfer to campus Y. Many of the students that are distributed across our system are indeed place bound. That is not a solution for them.
Representative March.
Wouldn't you also say, I mean, a lot of these students who are place bound by economics and resources? And I look at some of the lower income areas of Portland, and those folks are just as place bound as somebody in La Grande. So, you know, there's even in a high growth area. So you've got a playoff here of two place-bound groups, one with a high-growth campus and one with a low-growth campus, for example.
Madam Chair, Representative Marsh, that is indeed correct. Finances is the most critical factor in limiting students' mobility. As you see the age of our students, the average age of our student profile increase, you're looking at more and more students who are, in fact, working students who are dependent on all kinds of other relationships that keep them in a place, as well as the basic economics of tuition and financial aid. So that certainly is the case in all of our campuses. I would like to emphasize...
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley. Thank you. Chancellor, it would be helpful to me as we continue to hear the list of campuses that fit the faster growth category and then the campuses that fit the slower growth category, just so that I can better track your references.
Madam Chair, Senator Gordley, in terms of the initial proposals, and if I please may stress, initial proposals at a time where we don't know tuition and we don't know the final resolution on the general fund, those campuses which have indicated that they would seek to enroll additional students on the margin would include Portland State, University of Oregon, Eastern Oregon University. The remaining campuses will be seeking to hold or more modestly increase their enrollments. And what we do is then create a tension between those who meet their targets and those who can assist the system on the margin. And I do want to stress, all campuses are meeting their targets.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, if I could draw one other piece of obligation into this, because I think it's an important one. As I've tried to say several times in testimony, I believe we do have an effective K-16 system in our state, and it's a system of opportunity. If the slower growth campuses are then driven to reductions, which would be greater than their share of general fund, that would mean the general fund would be going down by whatever it ends up. If the proportional hit to the slower growth campuses is even greater than that, those effects spread out into our relationships with the rest of K-16. They will limit the opportunity for degree completion with local community colleges, and that will adversely affect their ability to serve their students. They will adversely impact our relationships with the teachers in our schools, as those institutions are driven to suffer more than their proportional share of a reduction. And so, Madam Chair, our strategy has been as follows. Next slide, please. If we have to reduce state support, and we obviously know that we do, Then we've attempted to adopt the following strategic options. To backfill with tuition within the limits of affordability, and we certainly have pressed that, we believe, as far as we can go. That means with a few remissions to mitigate the impact upon the most needy, but it does mean also substantial increases in tuition. Secondly, to reduce fundable FTE, those enrollments that the state funds support, equitably, fully using the RAM, taking the money out using the RAM just as the money was put in using the RAM, and the allocation function that Mr. Bender described. And then thirdly, to say those campuses that can enroll additional FTE on the margin are encouraged to do so, as long as they can support those students at a comparable quality of experience on the basis of their tuition alone.
Senator Mazzoli.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sir, if I could have you go back to slide 7.
Sure.
The second bullet point, local regional community colleges who no longer have local degree completion opportunities for their students. Could you explain that more in depth of why they would be, why they would no longer have that, opportunity?
Madam Chair, Senator Mazzoli, certainly. What I'm saying is that for most of our students, the relationship between, for most of our institutions rather, the relationship between the university and a local community college or community colleges within the region is pretty geographically bound. So if we have institutions who are taking more than their share of cuts, what that means is they shrink their opportunity for additional access. They're no longer able to offer the additional sections of courses. And you'll find, as we hear from the presidents, students can get admitted, they won't be able to get the courses they need. That means it ripples then out into the related community colleges who are serving their students and advertising their programs on the basis of start here, finish up at the local university. If that local university access is diminished and access to courses is diminished, then the opportunity for the community colleges to offer that 2+2, that transfer opportunity, will correspondingly be shrunken. And I think that's a serious impact for us as we try to look statewide and regionally out across this set of problems.
I think so, Madam Chair. I'm concerned about that because I think as we work our way through this economy, that is an opportunity that many of our people that are looking for an education are going to have to go to spend more time at the community colleges and then finish up either through distance learning or through brief periods on campus to finish their degrees.
Madam Chair, Senator Mazzoli, if I may add a further comment, I noticed on the enrollment numbers provided by Mr. Bender that the community colleges too were projecting a downward softening on enrollment. So that further adds to this challenge of maintaining access across all elements of public post-secondary.
Thank you.
Chancellor Jarvis, with relation to the loss of access to community college students into the higher ed system, do you have any information to us about how many students you expect will be impacted and what the financial impact is? I think what I'm curious about is if we were to look at this from the point of view of a restoration, what kind of dollars are we talking about and how many students would be impacted by that?
Madam Chair, if we could get back to you on that. I don't have a number in my head that I could apply to that.
I think that you can appreciate that as we work through the priority discussions that we need to work through, that the more specific information that we have about costs and impacts, that the easier the discussions are going to end up going.
Certainly, Madam Chair. Try to do that. If I could add one last comment, one last bullet on the very last slide, and responding to the question asked by Senator Gordley on, I believe, Thursday. We have delivered to you our report on, our system diversity initiatives. I met with the presidents on Friday, and we wanted to make the statement for each campus and for the system as a whole that as we go through this reduction process, we will maintain our commitment to the diversity initiatives outlined in that report and to the continuing progress that we've made in that area. So I would like to put that on the record and represent the complete support of the presidents in doing that. And with that, I would pass on to Vice Chancellor Andres.
Questions or comments? Further questions or comments for Chancellor Jarvis? Let us then move ahead to Mr. Andres.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Tom Andres. I'm the Senior Vice Chancellor for Finance and Administration with the Oregon University System. What I'd like to do is provide a system-wide context. I think before that. No, that's good. I'd like to provide a system-wide context for looking at reduction alternatives. I think you'll get a sense of structure from that, but I think where you'll really get more of the understanding of impact and implication will be when each of the campuses comes up and begins to speak a little bit to how it affects them in a different fashion. But let me give a little bit of the background. We have a requirement right now to provide 2% through 10% reduction scenarios, $13.5 million up to $66 million. What I'd like to do today, if it works out for the committee, is hopefully put more of a focus on the end of that, the high end, particularly 8 and 10%, not because we're seeking that, but because as we look at the accumulation, we're really dealing with the same set of priorities, only at a slightly higher level. And I think understanding it at that level, in terms of the numbers of students that would not be funded and so forth, might be easier or more useful for the committee. Next. Very briefly, how were the reduction options determined? We went through a very extensive review of priorities. There's been a great deal of planning at the campus and system levels. One of the things that we wanted to make sure is that whatever we brought forward in terms of that extended list of 55 priorities, you could look from the bottom up on that and see what the reduction alternatives would be. So the two are very much connected. We've also tried to look closely at what we did in the last biennium, 2001-2003. What were the reasons? What were the areas that were reduced? Why? What were the long-term implications? So that became part of the process. Also, there's an intent to maintain access. And as the Chancellor has stated, there is a point at which maintaining access gets very difficult. And right now it appears to be in that 5 to 6% range. And we'll see some numbers on that shortly. Also, as we look at the reduction scenarios, there is a very heavy reduction in the areas of undergraduate and graduate education, which are the areas where basically all of the money resides. We've got $522 million approximately out of a budget analysis portion of $661 million. So obviously, as we're looking at a $66 million reduction at the 10% level, those are going to be taking a hit. They are proportional, however. I would say that looking at the undergraduate and graduate components, they are being looked at each of the increments 2, 4, 6, 8, 10 on a proportional basis and not beyond that. What I'd like to do is go to slide 13, if possible.
If I might just kind of recap this for just from the point of view of trying to make sure that I have it straight in my own head. What you're saying then is when we get to the level where we're making cuts in the 6% range, then we will actually start seeing reductions in student enrollment.
It will be right at that point that we're seeing as the kind of the tipping point, Chair Morgan.
And then the other thing, the last point that you're making is because 80% of your budget is in undergraduate, graduate priorities, that's where the bulk of the cuts are going to occur.
That's correct. Proportionally speaking, Madam Chair, they're actually no higher than the increment that they're in, but because there's such a large amount of funding, they make up the bulk of the dollars. Let me start at 8%, and there is actually information on 6 that we could look at, but we can go back to that if needed. But I think this begins to provide the information that we're most interested in. At 8%, we're looking at a $53 million reduction. Okay, that's a loss of 9,800 fundable enrollment. That in this particular slide, what you see are the additions. When we're looking at 2, 4, 6%, these are now the additions on top of that that drive to that $53 million figure. And I'll have a cumulative total in the next slide. But what it means is, as an example, the statewide public service building maintenance, 7.5%. It's at the 8% increment that they're reduced an additional 7.5%, and at that point, that particular program is reduced 15%.
Now, could you give us some background about what exactly is this line item? What does it constitute in terms of services?
Yes, the statewide public service building maintenance is an amount of funding, approximately $4.2 million, I believe, that is with Oregon State University. And it's I'm not sure Mr. Bender may be able to explain. It sits outside the statewide public service budget, which you look at separately, and it's been aligned with our budget, and I believe there's some historical reason for that, but I'm not really sure what it is. But we actually deal with that as a separate line item.
Mr. Bender, do you have increased information to give the committee?
The statewide public services of OSU, the Agricultural Experiment Station, Extension Service, and Forest Research Laboratory, have most of their facilities on the OSU campus itself. Some of them are spread out in other parts of the state. And what this line item is designed to do is to provide the funding that goes separately to the statewide public service budgets, which you'll be looking at on Thursday, does not include funds specifically to maintain the facilities that these three services occupy on the OSU campus. And this is an additional line item to OSU that comes through the ENG budget to help support those particular costs. I think it's a feature of the transfer to the resource allocation model from the previous model, that when that was switched over, this particular element that had been funded under the old model, there was no direct means to fund these building maintenance costs. So it was added as a separate program. Fundamentally, what this is these are, all of these funds go to Oregon State University and help that institution fund its programs, and any reduction would go entirely, would be absorbed entirely by OSU as reductions are made.
So this doesn't relate to any of the statewide buildings that are located throughout the state. This only relates to statewide buildings that are on OSU campus?
I think probably not. I think it's just on campus.
It's just on campus, yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, capital construction is a $12.5 million biennial budget, basically for renovation projects on the campuses. The campus public services program, it takes in a whole array of different programs on the campuses. You've got regional service centers. You have small business activities. There's the public radio at SOU. There's really a number of these, of which this is funded at approximately, I believe it's $7.3 million. And at this point, what we're suggesting is a 6% reduction cumulative to 10%. System-wide expenses, there's about 15 different subcategories. This includes expenses to DOJ, assessments.
If I could just interrupt. Mr. Bender, do we have any kind of definitive list of what's included under campus public services?
Yes, we do. I don't have that here, but I'll bring that tomorrow.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, I have a copy of that, too, that I'd be happy to provide as needed. The undergraduate technology is a program that basically is a supplement. Both the undergraduate technology and the graduate engineering are programs that supplement, in effect, the cell values, the model, because they are not funded in terms of engineering support and technology support at the level that is necessary in terms of high-cost programs. Also, it is a strong policy position of the board in terms of emphasis on engineering and technology. The last entry, undergraduate and graduate education, 2%, that's 8% at that level. Go to the next slide. It'll give us a sense then of looking at the total array for this level. It's 8% scenario, $53 million. The ones I've just mentioned are those that were incrementally changed from 6% to 8%. at this level, you can see now the reductions in the right-hand column for all of the other various priorities that we're dealing with. It includes your capital. You can see the capital construction, system-wide expenses. It moves down engineering, the ETIC funding, research, and so forth. Those are, if reduced at 8%, these are the programs that we would be looking at, along with the reduction then of 98 fundable enrollment. Take that. I'm sorry.
Representative Marsh.
Okay. Let me follow that line through. So if, for example, undergraduate education would be reduced by 8%, does that translate into your RAM model that you're reducing each cell by 8%?
Madam Chair, Representative March, that is correct. This would be specifically related to the model, and we would end up reducing the RAM by whatever the appropriate level.
Then I have a follow-up question if you're done. Mm-hmm. You have further down cuts to undergraduate engineering. Can you talk about how those interrelate with the undergraduate education cuts in the first line?
Sure. Madam Chair, members of the committee, let me maybe go back a little bit on what I said to Representative March. We have two options. One option is to reduce the cell value. The other is if we actually have to eliminate the 9,800 enrollment, then the cell value would stay the same. And that's actually the position. The position of the board is to maintain that level of access or quality, and the fundability issue, I think, would be where we would put the emphasis, as opposed to reducing the cell value. Madam Chair?
Representative Bates.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think Representative March asked a key question, and I appreciate your answer. What is the number of fundable students you presently have? Do you know offhand? It's probably in the documents. I just can't find it real quick.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, we are looking at this biennium at about 116,000 fundable FTE. And we would be seeking on a biennial basis under the governor's budget. That would be that level that you've probably heard a lot about, the 118,000. Madam Chair?
Representative Bates?
I'm just trying to look at the policy here and try to support that policy, because I think I'm understanding what you're trying to do, and I do apologize for leaving earlier. You would basically have two choices, either to increase the amount of students that are being funded and decrease the amount they get per student, or to maintain what you feel is your important base, which is maintaining a certain amount of fundable students at a level that you think maintains your quality in your different centers. That's the basic policy you're now following.
That is correct. That is the board.
And so in making these budget reductions, you made the choice that you would start unfunding students instead of diluting the soup. And
that's correct.
That's basically what you're talking about here.
That is correct.
And so as we look at these documents, we should be thinking that way in our minds then.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes. There is a support document that talks about the options, but in truth, the board is really looking at the position of reducing the enrollments.
Follow-up, Madam Chair.
Follow-up.
Do you have any idea where those the students who used to be fundable and are now be unfundable, are they spread across all your campuses, or are they localized in certain types of campuses, or do you have any idea where they might fall out?
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, they would affect all of the campuses. Now, I'm sure that there are probably some that are hit harder, but I right now, given how that would fall at the 9,800% level or the 9,800 level versus also what's happening with the tuition and fees, we don't have a good handle on that right yet.
But would it be fair to say, as a general rule, that the high-growth, high-enrollment campuses have a better capacity to absorb the unfunded fundables than the small campuses with lower enrollment growth have?
Madam Chair, I think that's a correct characterization.
Representative March.
Actually, it kind of triggered another question is, since I imagine enrollment kind of goes up and down in the various campuses at various times, depending on students' whims and economic situations, is there some sort of reconciliation process that you go through to at the sort of end of the fiscal year to make sure that the model, while you funded it right out at the beginning, was appropriately distributed?
Madam Chair and Representative March, one of the major features of the model has been to look at a year-end, and if a campus has gone up, the particular emphasis, frankly, was on when we had a reserve. We used to have an enrollment reserve, and the idea was that if a campus exceeded the enrollments, there was an opportunity to go to that reserve and be able to provide funding. That was one of the casualties in the last biennium. So this final settle-up, as it's called, has really not been in force. It won't be in force at the end of this year. That's certainly a major and important feature of the model that we in the future would like to continue. But obviously, as we were talking about $80 million reductions, an enrollment reserve was kind of a luxury at that time.
Thank you.
Mr. Bender, I am curious about the piece in the RAM that relates to a weight for the small campuses. Can we get information on functionally just what that is in terms of what percentage of it? And I'm just would like, if it's possible, to have a step through on the impact that that has on a straight across distribution. And I also am not clear if there's other weights in the distribution formula besides that weight, and I would appreciate some information on whether there are other weights as well as the small campus weight.
These various items that you see listed here on the chart that 14 represent a number of what are called targeted programs. These are specific funding sources outside the cell values, except for the first two, that are, you know, that represent funds that are going in addition to those that are directly provided on a per student basis. One of those additional targeted programs that is not on this list is the small school funding, and they are not proposing any reductions in that, and that's why that's not shown on this list. But we'll get you tomorrow a complete list that would show all of these targeted programs for which there are reductions, plus any additional ones for which there are not reductions. I can't think of too many where there aren't reductions, but small schools would be one of them.
I think that's it. That is it.
That is it.
That's it.
Representative Bates.
Madam Chair, I'd like to make one last comment. First, I appreciate you being forthright and bringing to us the change in policy. I think it's a good one. I think you've made a wise decision. But I appreciate you bringing it forward to us. The one thing in your reductions program I'm still concerned about, and I just can't leave alone, is the fee remissions program. I would support higher tuition for students if some of that money rolled back into free fee remissions, and I'd hate to see the fee remissions program cut. I think it changes the character of our campuses when we start excluding people who have low income. Many of those people are ethnic minorities. Many of them are just low-income people who have a difficult time getting into our university system. And the biggest impediment to those people is cost. And quite frankly, there are people in the system of whom my kids are members that I could afford more tuition, and I would be glad to pay that. That money rolled back into fee remissions for other students who haven't got as much financial background. And I would really like to have you look at that again and think about it and see if there's any way of avoiding fee remissions. I know you've got some difficult choices there, but if you can maintain your fee remission program or even enhance it through tuition, I would be very supportive of that.
Madam Chair, Representative Bates, one of the problems we have right now is there is no good option when you get to 8 and 10, but we recognize your concern.
Thank you.
Could I go to 10? And then I think that will give us a kind of an overall final sense of where we're trying to go. At this point, and again, just kind of the broad brush view, $66.1 million. We're looking at a loss of just over 12,000 students. And you can see it's got greater implications, particularly as we look at the undergraduate and graduate education. They're proportionally at that level of 10%. That combines for over $52 million, or about $52 million for undergraduate and graduate education. That relates to the cells. The chancellor's office drops $2.5 million, and then and kind of so on down the list. These have been very difficult, but they also represent, when looking in the bigger picture, in the context of the original 90% in terms of our overall priorities, these are the realistic areas for us to look as we have to move from 6 to 8 to 10%. And again, this is very broad brush, and I realize that there is more detail, and I'm sure you'd really enjoy reading it, but it's there is more detail on day four that provides background on each one of these areas. It goes through each one and gives a 2 or 3 line explanation along with the total funding. But perhaps at this time, this would be a good time for, at the 10% level, one thing that is important is that as we talk about the level of fundable, we've talked about 12,000, we've talked about 66 million. What we're looking at then is being able to serve approximately 106,000 students, fundable students. And again, going back to what the chancellor had said, I think our ability to really accept additional students, and certainly if it's the 6% level, it's even more so at the 10% level, is going to be largely positioned on our ability to have that proposed tuition increase. It's a major part of our access program, if reduced at these levels. And perhaps the presidents can shed a little more light as it relates to each of their campuses.
Before we leave this discussion, I do have a couple of questions that I'd like to ask. With relation to the OSU Cascades campus, we see at the 10% level a 5% cut in that program. Given that this is a new addition to the system, and we have been having a lot of discussion around last in, first out, why is the, can you give the committee, from your policy perspective and the discussions that have been taking place in the chancellor's office and amongst the presidents, why you're not choosing to mothball this?
If I may pick up that one, Madam Chair, members of the committee. The recommendation that you see is the recommendation of the board that we've discussed through on this. This is a startup operation. It's meeting its growth factors, and it appears to us to be on track to meeting a need that was established when the program was started. The reason you see it cut at 5% is that when you're very small and startup, there are critical mass issues that you just can't offer 2/3 of an office or half of an office, and so its reduction rate would be less than across the board 10%. Why we wouldn't close it all together to the fundamental question is that we believe there is need and demand there that needs to be addressed, and that the institution, within the limits of its funding, is indeed doing that. So we would like to keep it going.
The follow-up question I would have is that, given the discussions that you've obviously had about thinning the soup, I'm still kind of mystified about why you're choosing to thin the soup and keep this campus going when you could, and I don't know what the shutdown costs are or what things related to that kind of discussion are, but it would seem that if you were trying to keep the most funding in place underneath the student body to maintain the quality issue, that that mothballing this would need to be part of that discussion. So it's curious that you would choose to maintain an expansion of the system at a time when that puts a degree of strain on it.
Madam Chair, if I may, I certainly appreciate the dilemma. It is the very one that we have struggled with. The decision that the board came to, I think, was based on the demonstrated demand in that area, and the fact that it would not be met otherwise, that this institution was delivering on the plan that it was set out to do, and that as a system evolves, it evolves to meet those needs. And anything that we close reduces access for one group of students, as we pointed out here today. And so that is the decision that we've wrestled with. It isn't as you put it.
What I would ask you to do is to work with our LFO staff so that the committee can get a picture of what the situation would be financially to close the campus down, what the upside and what the downside of doing that is. I think that's a piece that we need to have a discussion around. The other issue that I want to talk about is the chancellor's office itself. The given, again, that we have huge constraints on actually what I would consider to be the number one priority, which is to make sure that we're serving the greatest number of students with the highest quality education that we can, given this crummy financial situation that we find ourselves in. What I would be interested in is a discussion about what is going on in the chancellor's office to try to streamline the functioning there and decrease the cost, and kind of I'm curious about what kind of out-of-the-box thinking is taking place with reference to redefining the services that you provide and moving as much of the money as possible down to the campuses.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, see, there's a number of areas that we're going in. First of all, as the Chancellor had mentioned, we sustained a 13% reduction in the Chancellor's office in the last biennium. And as we look at another 10% and looking at about 25% of our operation, obviously there's a lot of things that we have to do. One of those areas is in the area of information technology. Actually, two major areas that sustain a lot of activity with the institutions are in the area of financial management, controller, payroll function, and information technology are two major areas. As we look at the services that we're providing the campuses, and a number of the campuses, particularly the regional campuses right now, do not have on-site IT facilities, activities, staffing, and so forth. That's an area that, as we move farther and farther into the services that we provide, we'll have to look at what campuses can do more locally, whether it's in the area of financial management, information technology. One of the things that we found, because we kind of did an analysis over a number of instances in the last 2 years, that as we talk about reducing the level of services and the kinds of things we do, particularly on those two fronts, we end up shifting costs. And I know that's something that none of the campuses want, and one of our problems is trying to figure out that as we shift a function, shift an activity, can that be done at a reduced cost? So part of what our review will be as we have to deal with this, the reality of this, will be looking at those two areas in particular, although there's many things, that many services that we provide to the board and to the state, and working with LFO, working with DAS, that we'll certainly be looking at as well.
Is it a true statement to say that the large campuses, being Portland State, OSU, and U of O, have within their structures information technology and financial management capabilities to take care of their own needs?
Madam Chair, to varying degrees they do, yes. They have IT staffs. There are many services that we still provide centrally that they rely on, but they do have staffs as opposed to the regional campuses that may have one person or somebody.
So, again, the question here is one of capacity on the smaller campuses in terms of these services?
It's a significant part of it, yes.
Have you had any discussions about having the large campuses possibly provide services to the smaller campuses in these areas?
Madam Chair, we have actually, again, it was about a year and a half ago, we were talking with one of the campuses about that possibility. The possibility is there, much as is the kind of putting the utility down on the campus. But one of the problems that you have is saving dollars. If an Oregon State University takes on the function of providing the regional campuses with the same services that we're providing, we don't envision that there would be much of a savings, if any, in terms of the staffing that was necessary and the support that they would give. In other words, their staffing is different and configured differently in terms of what they would provide versus the kind of services that we provide now for the smaller campuses.
Mr. Bender, I think that this is an area that it would be fruitful for the committee to work in And I realize that discussions about changing the configurations of services are often really problematic because there's implementation and the study issues and implementation issues and things like that. But I think that it may be a worthwhile thing to explore in terms of a budget note that we have this issue studied over the interim to see if there are things that can be done to streamline the functioning inside of the chancellor's office in terms of the services that are provided to the campuses, and with the hope of, or the, just trying to open the door on a discussion about having more of the services take place within the campuses themselves and diminishing activity within the chancellor's office. And with that, have you, anyone else have any questions or comments? Senator Gordley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Did you tell us what the 10% cut to the chancellor's office represents? We have a dollar figure, but in terms of actual programs and services, what would be the impact?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gordley, I could not tell you that. I can tell you that within the general scope of the discussion that we've had, those are areas that right now represent about 60% of the costs of the chancellor's office. So they are logically the ones that we would be looking at for greater efficiencies and reductions.
I'm sorry, I'm not understanding. What represents 60% of the cost?
The financial management, the controller function, and the IT areas are the areas that represent the a majority of the funding in the chancellor's office. So those would clearly be areas we'd look at with a 10% reduction.
Also, I'm noting that there is an Office of Legal Affairs, which appears to have a little over five FTE. That office serves the chancellor's office or all of the university system?
Chair Morgan, Senator Gortley, it actually has a number of functions. It's a go-between with the Department of Justice. It works with those campuses that have legal staff, particularly Oregon State and U of O. It has the risk management function as part of that area, and it's also got a grants and contract oversight function that are key pieces of it.
And then one additional question, Madam Chair. I note in the Chancellor's office there's also a liaison with the Office of Governmental Relations in Washington, D.C. Can you say more about that function and how long we've had that position?
Well, I can't do that long. Madam Chair, Senator Gordon, I'm sorry, I don't know the history. I'd be happy to call Director Cairns to answer on that. The what the person does is to help us with the presentation of our system priorities for support at the federal level to bring us back information on where we can seek to find federal earmarks and where we can identify opportunities to pursue alternatives for federal funding. So it's a pursuit of resource function. At the present time, we're also very concerned about the Higher Ed Reauthorization Act, which affects all of higher education in the country, and so we use that office to keep us in tune with what's happening in the professional associations there.
I see. Thank you.
It's one person.
Thank you.
Chancellor Jarvis, I believe we are now at the place in the presentation where the university presidents will come forward and present. So if I could ask for the first group of presidents to come forward.
No, that's the number.
Good morning.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, I'm Tim White, the president of Oregon State University, and good morning to the rest of the subcommittee as well. There is a handout. I plan not to read every word, so don't get nervous. But I want to speak plainly with you this morning about how we will deal with the challenges that confront us. We appreciate the support and attention that you have given us in the past, and we understand and appreciate the severe and very real challenges we face together in trying to reach equitable solutions here. During the last legislative sessions, you have really attended to the compelling needs of Oregonians by helping us change the way in which we fund higher education, by actually increasing the general funds, although some have been taken back, by creating targeted programs in engineering and technology, the branch campus in Central Oregon, Four-Year College of Veterinary Medicine, and allowing us to generate and use other resources beyond the general fund, such as those from tuition and fees, grants and contracts, and gifts. This has helped not only Oregon State University, but it's helped the state. More graduates, more jobs, higher incomes, more companies, more tax dollars being generated back to the state, and new ideas that will continue to fuel the economy, our struggling economy. So as president of Oregon's land-grant university, I've decided absolutely that we are not going to manage decline, and I personally commit to each of you that we will employ the tools and investments that you have provided in a way that benefits all Oregonians. We will continue to provide maximum access to a quality education for a diverse range of students. We will conduct research that drives the entire state's economy, and we will deliver the benefits of our research through our outreach programs as well as our educational resources. We'll do this while facing significant reductions, while facing significant increases in the costs of our faculty and staff, and maintaining our facilities, and while we're facing increasing demand of students in Oregon. And we'll do it with innovation, with efficiency, and with excellence. As we face a possible 10% reduction in our budget, here are some of the things I worry about as we prepare to meet the challenges. The quality of our programs, no denying it. With increases in class size, the ratio of students to faculty has increased and will increase further. The unavailability of class sections will grow, therefore it'll take longer for students to reach their degrees. Personal attention, meaningful discussions, those are important for both students and for faculty, those will be diminished. Second, access to education. Tuition and fees over the last 2 years have increased and will likely increase in the future. And because of the economic downturn in our great state, during the current biennium we've removed 10% of our general fund budget. To accommodate this, we've done several things. Working with our students, we've added a tuition surcharge. It covers about half of the loss. We've stopped spending on instructional equipment, on academic renovations. We've decreased investments in building maintenance. We've not filled positions. We've held others open. We've not renewed contracts. And we've spent down fund balances that were encumbered for academic and learning investments. We've added $250,000 of net new money from both public and private sources to help with a need-based approach to the students at the lowest economic decile because of these surcharges. But I worry about this trend. We can't sustain it just with $250,000. But I'm happy to tell you that our Faculty Senate, without my request, on their own created a fund to help these students based on the request of Professor Ho, Chair of Biochemistry and Biophysics. Joanne and Ken Austin heard the story and on the spot gave us $32,000 as a matching fund for people to donate to help these low-income students. The Alumni Association heard about it, sent over $10,000, and the OSU Bookstore, a not-for-profit company that sells books on our store on our university campus, have provided $6,000 or $7,000. People are working together, and with that, we'll have a brighter future. But I worry that if students can afford to attend the OSU, they may not be able to enroll in their classes. And this is a very important point, and it's the way in which the student FTE story will be played out. It'll take longer for them to graduate. Fewer of them might result with degrees. Therefore, there will be fewer entering higher-paying jobs, longer to get ready for the job market, double-edged sword because then income taxes will go down further, and less money into the general fund. Attached to the material I gave you is a paper that shows graphically and conclusively how college graduates in Oregon, actually provide a significant return on their income taxes to the state, and that is for your information. What can the legislature do? You can help us control costs and enable us to be more efficient by passing Senate Bill 437, the Higher Ed Efficiency Act. You can help us address costs and solve the issue with PEB and PERS. You can enable us to continue to use tuition remissions to obviate the impacts of increased costs as one part of our integrated financial aid policy. What will Oregon State University do? Well, first of all, we'll be accountable. This last year, we adopted a new approach to our budgeting on campus that ensures that each department and program at Oregon State is funded based on current productivity, not on historical precedents. The funding follows the students into the classroom and laboratories. And last year, when we implemented this, Mr. Bender and Mr. McGee visited, and I think will attest to the fact that this is a very strong improvement for Oregon State University. We will be strategic. 18 months ago, we embarked on our ambitious strategic planning process called OSU 2007 that will continue the trend of increasing grants, the overall impact and value of our research and our instructional programs. And this is generated by hundreds of faculty, staff, students, and constituents, and is leading to a renaissance at the Oregon State University. And we will be diverse. We'll continue to be a diverse community, and attached to my testimony is a page that outlines some of the characteristics of these programs. Very importantly, however, a diverse campus enriches learning for all students, and that is a keystone point for us. And as cuts have come from the ability of OUS to help support it, we have backfilled it with our own money on our campus in order to not move away from that commitment. And finally, we will create dividends for Oregon's economy. Attached to my testimony is a map of how we are investing in each of Oregon's 36 counties. And only a small proportion of those dollars are general funds. The vast majority are derived by our work in attracting federal grants, gifts, and donations. Take, for example, the money we take and invest in research startup. When we hire new faculty members, it takes a certain amount of non-recurring money to create the laboratory and equipment for them to be successful. Listen carefully. For every $1 million in startup that we provide, we can generate in the first year $4.7 million in generally federal money that comes to the state of Oregon because of that $1 million investment. If you look at it over a two-year period from a new faculty member and watch them over 2 years, on average the return goes from 4.7 to 1 to 7.6 to 1. Over the last 5 years, we've invested $6.7 million in this way, with a return of $32 million coming to the state of Oregon. And I'm not speaking now about the secondary and tertiary impacts of that kind of return on investment, just the direct dollars. Also very importantly is these investments in research make our natural resource base more productive, they support the state's high-tech industry, and they are stimulating the emerging biosciences industry in Oregon across the board. Later this week, you will hear testimony from us about our statewide public service programs, the Extension, Ag Experiment Station, and the Forest Research Lab. That'll be on Thursday. Let me just say today that they are the lifeline for the state's economy, so much so that a number of the industries generate their own taxes and fees in order to support those programs. In conclusion, Madam Chair, I'd like to be clear. The reductions over the current biennium and those contemplated for the next one will result in lost jobs and lost opportunities. They will result in larger classes and classes that are closed and unavailable to students, restricting their access to an education and progress to degree. It'll delay their entry into the workforce. It'll delay their entry into paying taxes into the state of Oregon. It may ultimately result in the elimination of programs and our inability to start new ones that more directly meet the state's needs. But with confidence, I tell you that regardless of what reductions must be taken in our education and general budget, we will continue to invest as best we can in the research and the instructional programs that continue to generate these dividends. Moving Oregon State University forward during a time of state budget decline is indeed a monumental undertaking, but also an invigorating challenge and an uncommon opportunity. It is imperative that we continue to look to the future. We will continue to take actions to create and protect that future, and we will do it together, for the answers to these challenges are born within each of us. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Questions or comments for President White? Thank you very much for those thoughtful comments. We appreciate receiving them.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Chair Morgan and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Martha Ann Dowell, President of Oregon Institute of Technology. And also thank you for the opportunity with all of the other presidents today to give you the impacts on our own campuses, but to also talk to you about the positive ways that Oregon and the university system can move forward. OIT's mission is very focused, as you know, and I would just simply like to review that for you before I talk about specific opportunities as well as problems and solutions. Our mission is in the area of engineering, engineering technology, the applied sciences, and the health technologies. Because of that focused mission, we're quite unique in the Oregon higher ed system. And so we have a statewide mission to serve the entire state in those areas, and a tremendous impact, if not in huge numbers, in opportunities to impact the workforce needs. The examples of trying to provide both access and quality on a small campus with a focused mission are very complex. And some of the areas that I would like to speak to you about are those that make us unique for the state of Oregon and make us unique in solutions to solve these problems. This past biennium, as my other institution partners have experienced, OIT has experienced over a 10% reduction in our state resources. Within that reduction, then, we have had to freeze faculty positions, reorganize our administration, and actually eliminate certain student and administrative services, along with all the other given things, such as reducing travel, eliminating out-of-state travel, and so forth. As we have done this, we have tried to remain student-centered because the student success is still our number one goal. So our last resort has been to reduce sections for our courses at a campus that cannot afford to do multiple sections in the first place to keep our students on track for graduation. We have tried very hard to provide the courses necessary so that our students can graduate on time, and also that the student-faculty ratios in our classes are appropriate to an institution that uses as a trademark hands-on applied technological education. I'm very proud of the faculty expertise we have because they have industry experience and they bring to the classroom those kinds of hands-on opportunities first class. But as we look at the impact going into the next biennium, where are we going to go at an 8% and a 10% level? We will have still fewer sections. We will be dealing with PEB and PERS like everyone else, and we will have frozen faculty positions not to be replaced. What are our goals for the next biennium, and how congruent are they with the reality of the resources? Our goals are access for more women in engineering technology and more ethnic minorities. Our goals are also part of the Engineering Technology Council goal to double the number of engineering technology computer information students for Oregon. In the health industry, we right now are the only baccalaureate awarding degree institution in the state in the areas of diagnostic medical sonography, in the area of medical imaging, radiologic science, nuclear medicine. We also have a dental hygiene program that right now applications for that program are three times more than the number of students we can take. In addition to that, our medical imaging program has 150 new applicants, and we can afford 70. As I look at the impact on student access and quality, we will find that at the 8% and 10% reduction level, that we will enter close to 70 fewer students in programs that have extreme economic impact for the state, for businesses and industries. Up until the 8%, we are going to do everything in our power not to limit the enrollment. At 8%, we're going to tip over. As we look at what we need to do together, we need to not only look at priorities in terms of opportunities in higher education and the entire continuum, but we also need to look to the future impact of what will happen in the economy of Oregon as we have fewer employees for our businesses and our industries. I know very well OIT is not alone, but I think we provide an economic opportunity that is still profound. As far as the Efficiency Act, I would urge your support because it gives us more ability to be entrepreneurial, to begin to work with our own opportunities in the economic scene, and to, yes, invest tuition that for OIT in the next 2 years could allow us to support that additional 100 students that we may not be able to accept. We have capacity in some of our programs on campus. We do not have capacity in our health areas right now and in our computer area. And that is where there is an extreme need. I'm very grateful that the legislature and the board itself has recognized the small university funding, because for us, the RAM model does not work as efficiently until we get bigger and a little bit bigger and still a little bit bigger. So it's very important for us that the small university funding and also the opportunity in engineering technology are part of the priorities in the targeted programs in this budget. I thank you for this opportunity today. We want to work with you to make this the best higher education system in Oregon. Thank you very much.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Ms. Dell, for coming in. You know, I've talked privately before about the uniqueness of the programs offered at OIT. And they are certainly programs that provide immediate employment to our Oregonians. I'm not saying our other universities don't, but certainly the programs you offer on the high trend of the top employment. How many students do you enroll on campus yearly?
We have on the campus in Klamath Falls about 2,400 students. Our total headcount right now is about 3,100. We also have the Portland degree completion operation. And we have some contract training or educational programs with Boeing in Seattle and also at Fort Lewis in Washington.
What's in Fort Lewis in Washington?
It's an information technology program, Representative Smith, on the base there. It's in somewhat stress right now because of the current situation, but that was an opportunity that does not, of course, use state funding, but it's a contract training opportunity.
At these 8% reduction level, does your partnerships with the Portland campuses, are they in danger?
Yes. In fact, in Portland right now, we have an absolutely outstanding opportunity with Clackamas Community College. We share our facility on the Clackamas side called our Metro facility, and we are developing curriculum with them as I speak in the energy-related technology areas. They have partnerships with the utility companies, Pacific Power, PGE, and we are currently working on a degree completion degree with them. That would be one impact. We won't have dollars to do.
What about your applied health programs?
The applied health, of course, we have partnerships with Oregon Health Sciences University. This last year, we took on the management of clinical lab science and emergency medical technicians in Portland. We offer that as a joint degree, but we actually are responsible for the fiscal management and the enrollment right now, Representative Smith.
Thank you.
Representative March.
Thank you.
If I might also interject, committee members, we have five presidents who have not yet had an opportunity to share their thoughts with us. So
I'll pass on my question and I'll ask.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
If I might call forward the next panel of presidents, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Philip Kahn. I'm the president of Western Oregon University, and I thank you for this opportunity to share thoughts with you. Western Oregon University is almost 150 years old at this time, and in many ways this past decade has been the most productive, the most successful in the history of the institution. And I can mention some of those ways. At present, we have an all-time high enrollment, having just surpassed 5,000 students, and that's up 25% in the past decade. We've had a great clarification of our distinctive mission as a public arts and sciences college. Our national reputation in teacher education continues, and we've had notable expansion in key programs in areas such as biology, music, psychology, criminal justice. One thing that pleases us tremendously is our increased diversity, with over 12% of our student body now from underrepresented groups. Indeed, percentage-wise, we have the largest group of Latinos of any school in the system. And related to that, some 67% of our students qualify for and receive, not always to the extent they qualify, need-based assistance. Now, most of this, of course, comes from federal grants and loans. You can understand, then, at this time of growth, of an increased manifestation of our importance, that these cuts in general fund appropriations are beginning to have a major negative impact on Western Oregon's operation and this notable progress that we're enjoying. We are coping right now, of course, with some $4 million in cuts from what was originally appropriated in the 2001-03 budget, and that represents about 10.6% of that legislative appropriation. Let me give you a bit of context for the comments I want to make in the remaining period. Among the four public universities in the Willamette Valley, we take great pride in being a public liberal arts college. And that means that, as distinct from Portland State, a fine urban university, Oregon State, a land-grant university, University of Oregon, an outstanding research university, we are a liberal arts college. We are the small college alternative. And in that regard, we enjoy being highly interactive, nurturing. We enjoy a campus environment where we have a lot of face-to-face interaction between faculty and students. And we, of course, then expect strong student support services. We emphasize what we call the total collegiate experience, which means a rich mix of curricular, co-curricular, and extracurricular activities. You can understand, then, that budget cuts that pose a threat to this distinctive character bother us tremendously, this character with personal attention, with support and mentoring of students. And that is precisely what is happening on two fronts. As I indicated, our student numbers are up significantly, but faculty numbers have remained the same, and indeed full-time faculty, tenure-track faculty, is dropping. I was looking at literature just last week that boasted of our student-to-faculty ratio of 18 to 1. That is long ago, certainly before I came to Western Oregon University, because 5 years ago, our student-to-faculty ratio had gone to 23 to 1. This year, our student-faculty ratio is 28 to 1, having gone from 18 to 1 to 28 to 1, and you can imagine what that does to impact the character of a school such as ours. Additionally, over 40% of our faculty members now are part-time, which is to say that we employ them to lecture but not to provide the support services, advising, and mentoring that is characteristic of a school such as ours. So many of the positions we have had to eliminate and are eliminating are in the student support area. 10 such positions were slashed after the failure of Measure 28. And our plan for a reduction of 6% additional would eliminate 20 more positions. And I'm going to mention areas where those cuts are taking place if the 6% additional cuts occur. Our public safety unit, which maintains order and security on campus, will be cut from 14 positions to 7, cut in half, with the elimination of our dispatch service. Our career services was 3. It is now 2. It would go to 1 with a 6% reduction. Multicultural student services would be the same, having been 3, now 2. It would go to 1. International student support services was 3, from 2 then to 1. And there would be also cuts, I will not go into detail, in our Office of Financial Aid, our Office of Admissions, our Office of Disability Services. I could list other areas where we will have significant cuts. Academic support services would be reduced 10 positions at the 6% reduction level. Business operations, 2.5. Physical plant, 6.5. I won't list all of these, but of course it totals 30 positions. As you can understand, we are struggling to keep our faculty numbers where they have been for many years, because even with that, with the increase of some 25%, we hope 30% in our student body, the faculty-to-student ratio is not what we would like for it to be. Let me assure you that we are feeling increasingly positive about our contribution to the economy, the quality of life of Oregon, so we will continue to work at being among the best public arts and sciences colleges in the country. We, of course, emphasize access. We emphasize opportunity for a broad range of Oregonians. We emphasize the type of nurturance of which I've spoken. We emphasize quality. All of these values, which I know you prescribe and agree to, do take funding, and we, of course, seek your support and know you'll give us all you can in supporting this funding. Thank you.
Thank you. President Crane.
Madam Chair Morgan, members of the committee, good morning. My name is John Miller. I'm Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs at Eastern Oregon University. I'm very happy to be here today. I'm pleased to speak to you today regarding the implications of additional reductions at Eastern Oregon University. In my testimony, I want to focus on some facts about Eastern and the role Eastern plays in the Eastern Oregon region. Eastern Oregon University is truly a regional university. Eastern Oregon University serves a region covering roughly 60% of the state, both rural and urban. We provide educational opportunities not only in LeGrand, but throughout Oregon and beyond through our nationally acclaimed distance learning program. The LeGrand campus serves as a cultural, social, an educational hub for residents of Eastern Oregon. But most importantly, Eastern serves as the economic engine to support the growth of the region's economy. Our fall 2002 enrollment growth of 17%, coupled with our successful past partnerships, current partnerships with other OUS institutions and regional community colleges, has positioned Eastern to provide leadership in developing effective and efficient partnerships that provide access and opportunity to all Oregonians. For example, Eastern has a long time relationship, about 20 years, with the Oregon Health Sciences University with their nursing program. We also work very closely with Oregon State University. We host the Ag program at Eastern. And we're very happy to see some interest in Oregon State University in growing that particular program. It's a very popular one in our part of the state. We are also a major player at the Cascades campus, providing education programs both at the undergraduate and graduate level. We work with PSU in electrical engineering program. We partner with them. We also work very closely with our two regional community colleges, Treasure Valley and Blue Mountain, in our Eastern Oregon Collaborative. My point is that while we educate an increasing number of students, both on and off of the LeGrand campus, EOU, via its mission, also has a growing economic impact on the Eastern Oregon region and is playing a leadership role in workforce development. Specifically, our programs educate and prepare a quality workforce necessary to diversify and rebuild our economy. I think it's significant that over two-thirds of our graduates after graduation work and live within 200 miles of LaGrande. These are school teachers. These are small businessmen and women. They're helping grow our part of the state. The increased number of students also are being drawn into Union County. They've had a significant impact on our local economy. And projects such as our Science Center, it's the largest project in the region, provides family wage jobs in support of the local economy. So additional reductions will not only impact Eastern's ability to provide access to quality liberal arts and professional education and business and education, but also impair Eastern's ability to partner as a key player in the region's economy. Eastern managed this year's cuts via tuition increases, increased financial aid, budget freezes, targeted cuts, and enrollment growth. As we anticipate additional cuts, we will need the flexibility to use these same strategies, plus we are supporting the OUS flexibility initiatives that will provide the savings that we can use then to support additional students that will not be receiving state aid. Eastern Oregon University and our regional partners look forward to working in collaboration with our OUS colleagues, the legislature, and the governor in addressing the unprecedented challenges we face. I thank you for this opportunity to visit with you, and we'll accept any questions you might have. Thank you.
Questions or comments for the panel? Senator Gordon.
Yes. Madam Chair, did you wish to hear from all of the presidents before we take questions? Or
Depends on the burning intensity of your desire to ask a question.
Let me fly ahead then. For President Kahn.
Yes.
Chancellor Jarvis told us at the beginning of this hearing that the presidents all met on Friday and agreed or committed to maintaining your commitment to diversity initiatives on the various campuses. My question is this: with a cut to multicultural services, as you outlined, and also with a reduction to the FEAM remission program, which is at the highest end of the first to eliminate list, how will you do that? How will you maintain these commitments to diversity and to access?
As is true of the other campuses, Madam Senator, Chair, we will return a part of the tuition increase that is envisioned for the neediest of our students, and that's where we're talking about financial need. We fully intend to support the students as best we can in terms of their financial need. We are concerned that the programming for multicultural students is something that will be curtailed. We are hard-pressed to know what to do about it, but certainly that will not diminish our dedication to giving financial support for the students we have. Let me tell you how strange this is, often paradoxes. We were literally confronted this year, having had a retirement of a Spanish professor, with whether to eliminate a teaching position in Spanish or a reduction in the staff that I have just mentioned. But those are the kind of dilemmas that face us. And you either eliminate faculty positions in some area or staff positions, or you send tuition increases out of the roof. And so I do not know the answers to the dilemma, except to say that we are deeply committed, will continue to be, in supporting promoting diversity and in supporting all of our students from underrepresented groups to the maximum extent possible.
And I guess, Madam Chair, that's the crux of all of this. What we have clearly is commitment and dedication, but the university's ability to carry through on the commitment through programs and other services will be inhibited, and we need to be very clear about that. And at this point, Madam Chair, I would just like to say that I want to be associated with the earlier strong statements made by Representative Bates about the need to keep the fee remission program, which is tied to the heart of access. And again remind us and focus us on the point that that's a public policy choice, and I believe strongly, firmly, that it's a public policy that we should not support.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for sharing your time with us, and I will call forward the next panel.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Daniel Bernstein. I'm the president of Portland State University. I'd like to begin by providing you with a brief overview of the impact of the new model has had on Portland State University. In 1990, as we said we would, we would serve more students, improve the quality of our programs, invest in programs that serve the region and the state, and make improvements in our campus infrastructure, and we were able to accomplish that. Since 1999, our enrollment has grown from 19,300 students to 22,950, a growth rate of about 16%. We have expanded partnerships with the community colleges, and our freshman inquiry course, which is nationally ranked by U.S. News and World Report, is now offered in four high schools, Jefferson, Vocational Village, Grant High School, and Westview High School. They've been very well received there, and but for lack of resources, we'd be offering those the inquiry course at other high schools, particularly in some of the rural regions as well. We've worked to improve the quality of our programs. We've been building on areas of excellence such as the integrated circuit design and testing laboratory, which is the link to the region's semiconductor industry. Our Center for Lakes and Reservoirs, which is working on aquatic nuisance species issues that are important to our agricultural and shipping industries. Nanotechnology and nanoscience are also becoming major centers of excellence at Portland State. We've invested in our faculty in terms of faculty salaries and have made improvements in faculty salaries, although a major concern now is that there'll be a significant retrenchment in our ability to address that major issue, and that there will be really an adverse effect on our ability to attract and retain the very best faculty for Portland State. We've invested in programs that serve the region by making engineering, science, and technology a priority. We continue to work with OHSU on collaborative programs, and we've also increased enrollment in the Graduate School of Education to address teacher shortfall. We said we'd make improvements in our campus infrastructure and upgrade our laboratories and equipment, and we've made targeted investments in deferred maintenance, particularly in our science buildings. We're finishing the fundraising for the new engineering building. Construction is well underway on our Native American Student and Community Center. We've expanded our child care center, and we've remodeled the library as well. In summary, we told you that we would, with the enrollment-driven model, that we would address major concerns, and we have. Although there have been significant cuts, we have been able to manage those cuts by focusing on non-academic entities and support services. We've had to lay off some staff members, including a rollback of a planned salary increase for our administrative staff. We've imposed a tuition surcharge in the winter and spring terms of about $125, which addresses only a portion of the shortfall from Measure 8. At PSU, affordability and access is a major part of our mission. We hope that we will be able to continue to keep that as a priority as we continue to work through the current budget challenges. I've appointed a faculty, staff, and student budget committee to make recommendations to me on how the campus can address future cuts and at the same time hopefully continue our upward trajectory in terms of continuing to grow our enrollment, to grow in terms of our regional, statewide, national, and growing international recognition as a university, to continue to grow in terms of our public and private partnerships related to entrepreneurial activities, and also continue to grow in terms of providing multiple funding streams for the university. We want to serve more students. We want to continue to build recognition and improve quality. We want to serve the needs of the region, and we've added a new priority, and we've always pursued it. We're just doing it with more purpose now, and that is serving as a major economic developer in the Portland metropolitan area, and we are engaged in some significant projects, particularly a new dormitory that will begin construction soon. We've also, just 2 weeks ago, Octavian Technologies moved to PSU in a business agreement made possible by the legislation you approved last year that was ratified by the voters in Measure 10 that allows us now to house incubators as a part of our activity. We hope that we can continue to meet the challenges. Of course, a predictable budget is always preferable. Clearly, there needs to be some issues, some addressing some issues related to PERS reform, greater flexibility in terms of the initiatives, and also support for our deferred maintenance and other priorities. Thank you.
Thank you. President Frohnmayer.
Thank you very much, Chair Morgan. For the record, I'm Dave Frohnmayer, President of the University of Oregon. I appreciate the opportunity to testify this morning. I know that our time is limited, so I will try to be crisp and to the point. I want to cover a number of topics, at least briefly. First of all, to give you a picture of our current financial situation. Second, the demographics of our student body, because it's quite relevant to the fact that enrollments, in fact, we expect to increase and increase dramatically, at least until the year 2009, and we're part of that even if we're in a financially difficult circumstance. I'd like to describe our enrollment trends and our experience, how we're managing our financial circumstances, which I know is a concern of this committee, especially looking forward. Hopefully also touch on the economic impact of the University of Oregon on the state as a whole, given the fact that we are the state's 18th largest entity in terms of employment, in terms of economic impact, and finally some of the tools that we believe will bear on maintaining both quality of our instructional and research programs as well as access by students. In the process of doing that, I'd like to address it directly or indirectly the questions or concerns posed by Senator Messerly concerning our relationship to community colleges and the need for as many students to get education as possible wherever they get it, concerns raised by Senator Gordley with respect to access by students of all diverse backgrounds, and particularly the importance of doing that with limited resources, the chair's questions about the relationship between the fast enrollment and small, larger institutions as opposed to those that have more slower pace in getting enrollment and how this relates to the RAM model. I know that Representative Bates asked questions concerning financial aid and financial assistance, and I hope to address those, as well as questions about enrollment and enrollment management that I understand were raised last week by Representative Smith. That's a tall order for the next few minutes, and I'll try to do that within the time that that permits it. Our current financial circumstances are that at the close of the last biennium, we were given a general fund support for the University of Oregon over the biennium of $151 million. That has been cut by more than $12 million. Most of those cuts, as this committee is painfully aware, have fallen in the last few months of the biennium. The consequence is that when most of your expenses are in personnel, 80% of them, it's very, very difficult, especially when you have contractual obligations, to make those cuts. The consequence is, as the committee knows, that we met most of them by a tuition surcharge. which our students accepted after consultation that we think was as exhaustive as the circumstances permitted, but it's not desirable under any of the most optimal circumstances. I think the committee recognizes that, too. Those cuts have been had to been made in the circumstance in which our health care costs for our employees increased, in which retirement costs for our employees increased, and in which we had unprecedented increases in enrollment for which the enrollment reserve was taken away. So I think you could appreciate that we enter this next biennium in extremely difficult and painful circumstances. And while our tuition did increase through the surcharge, it still left us with a net revenue shortfall between the makeup for the general fund cut and what the tuition surcharge actually generated of something like $2.5 million of shortfall. So there is actually no net revenue increase for the University of Oregon by these calculations. It's a net cutback. Our health care costs, by the way, have increased during that same period of time. Addressing the question raised last week, I believe, by Representative Smith, one of our problems is that we can't simply turn enrollment on and off as a spigot. I think that's a reality that everyone recognizes. And we admitted students in good faith in the years 2000 and 2001 on the assumption that the enrollment increases would be accounted for by the RAM model and by the enrollment increase funds that were set aside. Those, of course, were the first to go in the early special session cutbacks of higher education. The consequence of that is that we have 1,000 students on the University of Oregon campus for whom there is no state funding at all. That is to say, their education is supported on the margin exclusively by the tuition and fees that they pay. There's obviously a limit to the number of students that can be supported at that level and with the quality of education that they expect from the University of Oregon and that we hope and indeed expect to give to those students. One of the slides I'm showing you is, I think, quite dramatic because it shows the enrollment increase just at the University of Oregon, and you can see that the upward line is virtually vertical. Now, we're proud at one level that students are voting by their feet, with their feet, to come to the University of Oregon. Part of that represents a demographic increase, but part of it also represents the fact that this has become increasingly an institution of choice, and we are proud of that. What we're not happy about is what the next slide shows, which is a graph that, if you trend it down, is going in exactly the opposite direction in terms of the state support per student. So if one is to maintain the quality of education, no surprise then that tuition dollars have increasingly replaced state dollars in an undesirable standpoint from a public institution's point of view. But if one wants to maintain public education at some level, that's obviously where you have to look. The next pie chart would show you something about the distribution of state revenue, and maybe what's interesting for you to look to is the red chart compared to the yellow one, because if you had seen this chart 10 years ago, it would be dramatically reversed. What we have now is a situation in which part of our grant and contract income, we now have an excess of federal dollars over an excess of state general fund dollars. That is to say, we get more dollars from the federal government for our overall operations than we now do from the state government. But the problem is that unlike the state dollars, the federal dollars aren't fungible. They're targeted, they're limited to peer-reviewed programs, they're the product of federal grants. We can't simply shift them into our operating expenses. So our overall flexibility in terms of our revenue picture has been very dramatically reduced. We don't expect that our progress is going to be slowed here. Our current enrollment is 20,044 students. That is an all-time record. Our freshman enrollment this last year had an average GPA of 3.24. That was a record. 3,247. Our GPA for those freshmen is 3.45. And just a preview of coming attractions, we expect, based upon what's in the mailbag and pending student acceptances, that the average GPA of the entering freshman next fall will exceed 3.5. So students of higher quality than ever before are enrolling and expecting to be enrolled, expecting to be educated with a quality education. And I might add with some reassurance to Senator Gordley and others of you that we have greater ethnic diversity in this incoming class than we've ever had in the history of the institution. So we expect and hope at least that we will continue to maintain the opportunity that has historically been the hallmark of a public institution. I'll skip the next couple of slides in the interest of time because I want to talk to what steps we have made. And I want to begin with a point that was made by my colleague from Oregon State University about how one deals with revenue shortfalls in a time of increasing student demand. We've done so in part, and this I think is responsive to Representative Smith's question of last week, by raising our admission standards, that is to say the standard of automatic admission to the University of Oregon, from 3.0 to 3.25. Paradoxically, that was accompanied by an increase, a record increase in the number of applications to the institution. And so what that means is, while we don't turn down students below a 3.25, at least those that we can guarantee automatic admission has been increased in terms of GPA and reduced in terms of absolute numbers. We've increased tuition to maintain access. We've also increased financial aid through increased scholarships and tuition remissions. And Representative Bates, I want to respond specifically to your question because notwithstanding the meta picture that one saw in the state board's reduction tactics, we propose to increase the amount of tuition remissions next year by $500,000 and the following year by $1 million at the University of Oregon. We've also received the equivalent of a $10 million endowment for scholarships, which is incredibly heartening at this time, from the state and family, a woman who ironically was not able to complete her education at the University of Oregon in the 1930s and has made this endowment for students. It serves students from all over the state of Oregon. We have numbers of Ford scholars on our campus, Representative Morgan. We in Oregon State University, I think, have the highest number on our campuses, but this is a very important road of access for students, particularly from underserved areas and Oregon's rural counties. And we are engaged in a capital campaign that will have the raising of scholarship monies as a central part of the capital campaign. It will be the largest capital campaign for any subject in the history of the state of Oregon, public or private. So those are some ways in which we hope to deal with the questions of continuing to allow access in this very difficult time. But I want to raise an issue about the tip-off point that President White alluded to, and this is very important, and this is why it's not so easy for each of the institutions to tell you that at 6% they lose X number of students, at 8% X plus something, and at 10% X plus something else. We prefer to talk about tip-over points because this is the point at which we lose students, not because we lose headcount, but because they can't complete their educations on the schedule that they want because we can't hire more professors, hire more instructors, add more sections. So it takes the same students by headcount a longer time to get their degrees on our campuses. So instead of taking 15 hours and getting through in 4 years or 4 years and one quarter, which is our average, it will now push toward 4.5 or 5 years. That's the consequence, in the first instance, of going to the 8% and 10% levels. And it's a very important one to remember because, as I've pointed out in the context of my remarks to Representative Smith, you don't suddenly stop admitting students. You've already admitted them. You already know what your demand is going to be. The problem is you can't meet the demand because you can't hire the extra faculty. You can't add the additional sections. They can't take the courses to get through on time. And not only does it take them longer, it means that they have to pay the additional living expenses for an additional quarter. That's probably $5,000 per quarter or a little bit less than that, counting tuition and fees. And in addition to that, every quarter that they have to stay at the university beyond that they wanted to means another quarter that they're not in the job force, paying back student loans, being productive taxpayers, being able to provide for families, being able to go on to the kinds of productive public service jobs that we hope that our graduates do. So those are the costs of the tip-off point, and that's why it's not linear. That's why it becomes cumulative and even much more serious as one approaches the 10% point of view. But these are, as I've indicated, the ways in which the University of Oregon intends to deal with the issues. And I'd be remiss if I didn't at least close by saying that we have tried to chart a path through strategic directions, which began more than a year ago, recognizing the state's budgetary difficulties and the terrible choices that you face as policymakers. And as part of that, we've developed a legislative package, Senate Bill 437, which, although it's an efficiency act and needs passage, is much more than efficiency because it recognizes that each of our institutions has its own individual circumstances that are best met by a package of support issues that are individual to each campus. that bill is now before your committee. We do urge its passage because it will give us the essential leverage and flexibility to deal to the maximum degree we can with the kind of difficult circumstances that we all face together. I have much more I wanted to say. I don't want to trespass on the committee's or my colleagues' time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your comments. We need to ask President Zinsser to come forward, and I would ask the members of the committee, if it's possible, to indulge the president, and we'll just keep running the committee until she's finished.
Sure.
I'd like to point out, Madam Chair, that you've saved the best for last.
Oh, man. Listen to that.
You're so impartial.
Yes.
Good morning.
Good morning. Chairwoman Morgan and members of the committee, thank you very, very much for hearing all of us this morning, and especially for these last moments of additional time, knowing the demands on your time. So thank you very much. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Zinsser, and I'm the president of Southern Oregon University. And I would like to try to avoid repeating a lot of things my colleagues have said, but give some highlights, nevertheless, about Southern Oregon University. We are a regional institution. Pride ourselves in being regionally responsive in everything from the arts to workforce development. We are also increasingly becoming nationally recognized for the quality of undergraduate education and innovation in teaching, and believe that in so doing, we bring additional value to our region and to our state. And furthermore, we are becoming increasingly internationally engaged, but only in focused areas that build upon the opportunities for Oregon, such as in Guanajuato, Mexico, which is already having some positive effects on trade relations with Mexico, and on the further development of our work in the Hispanic and Latino environment within Southern Oregon. I'd like to make a comment about an interesting juxtaposition that may on the surface sound a bit odd, and yet I think it's a wonderful story about what is taking place at Southern and what happens in Oregon in higher education in terms of the value that is brought to this state in higher education in relationship to the relative dollars that we are spending upon it. Southern Oregon University to the U.S. Department of Education is a Title III institution, and it is because our E&G, Education and General Fund, expenditures are just $9,175 per FTE student. That contrasts with an expenditure of $19,514 per FTE student in all four-year institutions across the nation. We are spending less than half per FTE student of E&G expenditures than the average four-year institution in this nation. That's a pretty sorry story on the front end of the comments, but I will tell you that we're very grateful to the support of Oregon for our institution and the others, and especially for the acknowledgement of the special needs of small schools. And so I want to add to some of my colleagues' comments about our appreciation for the small school funding. In making that observation, I would like to, though, comment on the value that is brought for even that small investment. We are able at Southern Oregon University to gain not only an increase in degree production of 39% in the last 5 years, but so we are serving our region, but we are at the same time gaining the national recognition of having been invited to be one of only 11 sites in the country in hosting a national conference on the future learning needs of students in the 21st century, and just last week hosted Lee Shulman, the president of the Carnegie Commission on the Advancement of Teaching. In addition, I would like to comment that though it may seem when you look at an institution like Southern Oregon University that we are a regional institution that takes in students as freshmen and graduates them in 5 or 6 years and they're going to school full time and it's all regional, 70% of our students have taken courses in other institutions, community colleges in particular, before they come to us. About 30% of them are traditional students. And so we have a very diverse institution. 80% of our students come from Oregon. 60% of our students come from our immediate region. And the out-of-state students give us significant leverage in enhancing the diversity of our student body. Some illustrations in certain fields of some of the wonderful stories at Southern Oregon University. You know that we are the designated institution of excellence in the fine and performing arts, and I simply want to comment that as one illustration, we're very proud that a young man, Brent Watkins, took second place in the annual Pacific Piano Competition in BC, and that's a major competition in piano, and that's one of many illustrations. We also are pleased to say that we received $500,000 in federal funds for developing a contemporary theater arts institute with K-12 and our Oregon Shakespeare Festival and Southern Oregon University. But I'd like to move to the sciences because this is a growing area for Southern Oregon University, and just comment on two areas of development in the sciences. One, our biochemical sciences and technologies are developing very rapidly, illustrated by the fact that we recently received $740,000 in federal and private support for the development of organic spectrometry laboratory and also for biotechnology research to develop a center in this area. We provide more hands-on learning for our students in the sciences. As a result of this, we have developed relationships with local businesses that provide opportunities for us to be a regional leader in biotechnology education and research in certain niches, and it gives our faculty an opportunity to not only do more in education but get involved in research and create partnerships with their colleagues in other universities in Oregon. The second is in the area of computer science. We've had some tremendous growth in this area and are very grateful to you for the support through the ETIC program. We received $186,000 in the biennium 99-01 and in the last biennium $500,000 to our endeavors in this area. And the results are, I think, very compelling. We have seen an increase of 3 regular faculty positions in this area, minimal given the growth that we're receiving, but nevertheless very helpful because the number of bachelor's degrees in computer science have increased 68% in the last 3 years. We have developed a new degree options in multimedia computer science working with the arts. And in this area, we have some real business opportunities that will come of it in addition to the fact that students are being trained in a very rapidly growing area. We have also been awarded special assistance and approval through ETIC for the cybersecurity initiative, needless to say, a very important area in today's world. And our faculty are very excited about being able to contribute to the research and education in cybersecurity, and we are also seeing now at least 3 businesses come to us with opportunities for internships for students, for grants and license opportunities in the technology area, and it provides our region a terrific opportunity to move into some new technologies of vital importance to us. In the professional areas, as you probably know, we have a great deal going on in business, in teacher preparation, applied psychology, nursing, criminology, and other professional fields. But I will just mention again to put a little human face on things that we're real excited that one of our relatively recent alumni from 1993, Terry Lund, who is in Cave Junction, was one of 5 teachers of music from across the country to receive the Mr. Holland's Opus Award this past year and ended up in Carnegie Hall in New York receiving that and bringing great pride to the state of Oregon as a teacher in this state. Criminology, I thought it might be helpful to mention, offers significant amount of distance learning opportunities for the Bend campus, so a lot of outreach is going on in our professions that move us beyond the immediate region. I thought it would also be helpful to make a remark about the partnerships we're developing. RCC and Southern Oregon University has had a long-standing partnership, and that is growing rather quickly because we have a tremendous growth in transfer students to our university, principally from RCC, but also from other community colleges. And just recently, RCC and Southern Oregon University forged a partnership to develop early childhood education that will be a 4-year program building on the 2-year program that they have offered for many years and filling in the gap between what we've always done at the master's level, what they've always done at the first 2 years, and we've filled in the gap for a 4-year program that will address the projected 60% growth in the next 5 years in our region for people who are practicing in the area of early childhood education. We have a great deal of growth in our activities in Medford. Our growth for place-bound students in Medford goes something like this. We've had a 19.5% increase in fall enrollments. We've had an 18.5% increase in the winter enrollments and a 28% increase for this spring. And we're very proud of that outreach effort and the developments of our opportunities to serve place-bound students in Medford and beyond. A word about diversity. Over the last 10 years, we've seen our principal growth in the area of Hispanic and Latino students and have also doubled. We've doubled in that area and increased by 23% the number of Native American students. We have larger challenges in the area of African American student growth, but we are seeing some progress there, and I think it has a great deal to do with, frankly, being able to bring on an African American faculty member who's been very helpful to us in this area. But our principal endeavor and our principal progress has been in the Native American area, and we have initiated a certificate program in Native American studies that is seeing some tremendous enrollment growth and also providing us a chance to enhance a program that's been around for 7 years, which we call Conaway, which serves middle school children from all around the region, and by that I mean the region out of state of Oregon as well, in the middle school years, and they come to campus for a week for a very intensive program, and they go back to their respective tribes and schools, and their grade point average goes up a whole percent on average as a result of spending 1 week on our campus and getting the kind of encouragement and development with respect to academic learning and the aspiration to go to college. I would be remiss not to make a remark about how pleased we are by the library funding, and particularly knowing that when the library project funding occurred and it came time for Southern to finally get to the point where its 18-year plan for this came to fruition, it occurred at a very difficult time for the legislature, and we greatly appreciate that support. It is well underway, greatly needed, the only academic library between Eugene and Chico, and also of great importance is that it's going to be providing tremendous employment opportunities for workers in our region. How did we approach the reductions in the last biennium? Just in a nutshell, many of the same strategies you heard from my colleagues. We have about a $39 million in state funds for our biennium. Our students are now paying a little larger share than the state funding in our budget. Our reduction was 11.2%, which amounted to $4.4 million, and that was before having to also make additional adjustments for the rise in PERS and the like. We were able to capture some funding through increased tuition, but kept our surcharge rather low. Our students are not among the more financially able students, and so we went at this rather conservatively, but we did hit the wall and have to increase it still further. But we took roughly $3.6 million in cuts, a great deal of it first in administration. We reduced a whole vice presidency area, and that was very difficult, and we're still adapting to that change at the upper level of the administration. And we're going through a great deal of work right now to consolidate a number of units and have already done that in certain areas. We've reduced services, travel, all of the things you've heard already. We reduced 27 positions by vacancies or attrition, and 22 people have been affected by layoffs and non-renewals. Having said that, we fully appreciate and understand our need to participate and are participating to the best of our ability in the reconciliation of budgets in these very difficult times. We're seeing the stresses on students, you've heard. The tuition increases certainly have impacted students, but we committed to a new affordability pool and expanded our traditional remission program significantly. And so far, we are managing to keep most of our students in school, but they are taking longer to graduate, and we're seeing a reduction in classes have an impact, as you have heard from my colleagues. We are seeing stresses on enrollment. I can, to answer the question that all of you are seeking from our individual institutions, we've begun to see some increases in potential enrollments with a terrific increase in applications. On the other hand, we're facing with our budget environment, we believe that we can grow on the margin some enrollment if we were at the 4% level in the reductions, but don't expect that to occur, of course. We believe at 6% we'll be holding our enrollment steady and not being able to increase on the margin, and we seriously expect we'll be seeing some reductions, unfortunately, if we are at the 8 or the 10% reductions. In a nutshell, then, I would say that our investments on the capital side have focused largely, in fact, almost exclusively, on energy efficiency code, such as fire code improvements and ADA code improvements in this last biennium, being very restrictive in what we've been able to do, but at the same time making some good progress. And finally, I want to add my voice to supporting the Efficiency Act and the Deferred Maintenance Bill. These are terrific opportunities for us. We would very much appreciate your support in these areas, as well as whatever efforts that can be made, which we know you're making, to ensure that the higher education system continues in a healthy way through this very difficult time. And since I'm batting last, I'll make the last comment from all of us, and that is that we're extremely pleased, in fact very heartened, by the expressions of support, the expressions of commitment that you all have to access to quality education and higher education, and to the recognition that quality is dependent on many factors, one of the most important being the diversity of our student body, our faculty, and our staff. These are important values. They are shared by the board and the chancellor staff, and all of us as presidents in our institutions, and those are our priorities as well, and it is very heartening, especially in these difficult times, to feel this kind of genuine partnership with you as you work your way through some extremely difficult decisions at the state level, just as we are doing on our institutions. Thank you very much.
Thank you. House members, our floor session started at 10:30, but we are excused from the floor session. And it isn't often that we have an opportunity to be in the same room with the presidents of the universities. And so I would encourage any questions that want to be asked to go ahead and do that.
Madam Chair, are we going to run until 11 then?
Well,
let me express my disappointment, not with the presidents. Their presentations have been fine with the time constraints that they've been given. I'm just going to restate a disappointment that I expressed last week. My disappointment is with our process, in that we are not allowing enough time, adequate time, to thoroughly analyze with the presidents who bring the expertise these huge public policy issues that we're faced with. And again, seven presidents and roughly 5-7 minutes apiece just isn't adequate, so I need to express that. And I want to encourage us to look at how we manage this process and how we can do it differently in a way that allows us to more thoroughly analyze the issues and in a way that allows us to respect the presidents and respect all of those who come before us to help us with this task. And so with that said, I'll be quiet and allow someone else to weigh in.
Senator Gordley, I think that we have continued to talk to each other on this issue over the course of all the presentations, because it is very frustrating to have people here that have the on-the-ground knowledge about how the systems work and the wisdom to put forward the solutions to this horrible dilemma that we're in. And I would just encourage you, as we go through this process at this very fast rate, to please work with LFO and work with the people that are here in the building representing the campuses to get answers to your question and to continue this dialogue. And this is, I share your feeling that this is much less than satisfying.
And actually, Madam Chair, if I may continue, my observation about the process and the way that we abuse it, if you will, relates not just to this committee, but to all of our committees. It's a process that we need to examine. And it's my disappointment with the process is just bubbling to the surface this morning. But I know that I am expressing a concern that many of my colleagues feel, and perhaps we have not taken our feelings beyond that to actually addressing how we modify our committee process, even if it means expanding our meetings so that we have evening meetings. But we need to address this in a way that allows us to hear fully from our partners, be they higher education, be they K-12, be they in the human services arena, so that as we make, again, these huge, huge public policy decisions, We're not just skating the surface.
Thank you. Further comments?
Madam Chair.
Representative Bates.
Just real quickly, Madam Chair, I absolutely share your feelings about this. I think we had some misunderstanding last week simply because we didn't have time to listen and the President didn't have time to present to us a full story on an issue. And that was only one issue. I really appreciate them taking their time. They're very busy. They have a huge responsibility, each of them do. And to come up here for an hour and a half or 2 hours and talk to us about these complex issues and the amounts of money involved is really unfair to them. I appreciate what you've done for us today, and I appreciate you coming up. But my frustration level, especially today, seems to be high because, you know, you came here, you've taken time from your jobs to come up here, and we have not been able to give you the time you really deserve. And I apologize for that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chairwoman Morgan and members of the committee, since I am sitting here, if I could speak on behalf of all my colleagues and tell you that we accept that, but we also want to say that we consider this to be a great privilege. We're very grateful for the time we've had this morning, and anyone and all of us would be more than happy to visit with you informally, to be available by telephone at any time, and to be called upon even on an informal discussion basis if that were to be needed. I know the Chancellor and all the Presidents would be happy to do that, but thank you so much for today.
I appreciate that, and I would just like once again to thank the Presidents for giving us their time and the benefit of their experience, because I think this has been a great learning experience for the members of the committee, and I think that all of us are frustrated at the short amount of time that we have to focus on your experiences. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 5021, adjourn this committee, and we'll reconvene at 8:30 tomorrow morning.